Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode. I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind, but there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What Was That Like? Contains adult language and content and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Today is September 11. Today is the day we remember and honor those who lost their lives here in America on September 11, 2001. 246 innocent people aboard the four planes that were hijacked. 2,606 people in the World Trade Center and the surrounding area. 343 of these were firefighters, and 71 were law enforcement officers. 125 people in the Pentagon. Today we're going to hear from two people who were there. Lori Brody and her brother Scott both worked at the World Trade Center. She survived, he did not. Lori will tell us what happened to her that day and in the years since. Joe Falco was a New York City firefighter. He was working to save lives at the World Trade Center and was injured when the buildings collapsed. May we never forget those who were lost on September 11, 2001. Lori Brody.
Yeah, I guess everybody says everyone has a story, and this happens to be my story, is what my friends told me. 15 years ago, my brother and I got up. We went to work on a normal, bright and sunny day. We got off the subway at the Trade Center, and he went up to his tower, which was Tower 1, or people know as the North Tower, and I went to mine, which is the Deutsche Bank building, which was connected to Tower 2. I can still remember what he was wearing. A nice pair of black Calvin Klein pants, a Kenneth Cole sweater with a little collar, that's beige, a nice pair of nice kind of cold tie shoes. That's how we dress back east. And me in my suit and my sneakers, because my heels were in my drawer at work. Right when I got to my desk, all of a sudden, you heard these loud bangs and noises and alarms firing, and everything went nuts. We were told just get away from the building. No one knew what was happening. Then we heard that a small commuter plane hit the tower, but nobody was hurt, and that's all we knew at that point. Then we later found out, as we were back at our desk, I'm trying to reach my brother. My brother was Scott Schertzer, and I couldn't reach him. And then Tower 2 got hit. We were told to run as fast as we could out. We had to run to the other side of the building because our windows were breaking. And I couldn't reach anybody in my family. A nice man named Mark Lubin saved my life because he made sure I got out, because I just went to a state of shock because I couldn't reach Scott. He made it to work on the 101st floor at Cantor Fitzgerald. And that's the last that I got to really see him, was that morning. Then it was just about running and more running and more running. And as the buildings collapsed around you, you just ran and hid in alleys, and you hid in alleyways and doorways. People covered you up, which was, I always said there was no such thing as chivalry, but the men were covering up all the women so that they would get whatever was flying in the air hit them. It didn't hit us. They would just cuddle us and everything. Then you had to keep running some more through inches and inches of soot or whatever was coming out of the buildings, and you can imagine maybe what would have been coming out. And we finally got an office building all the way down by the water, because we ran that way, we didn't run towards Midtown, we ran further away because that's the only way we could run. And it took me until 12:30 that day to even reach my parents. So my parents at that point didn't know if my brother or I made it. I was able to reach my dad after the first tower, but not after the second. And he knew that's the one that was attached to mine. So they were kind of a little bit more messed up than I guess even I was, because I was in shock more than anything else. But I almost knew he didn't make it. And at that point, I was trying to figure out, why did I survive and he didn't, when I worked at Cantor a year before that? So what happened? Why would this happen as F-15s are flying over your head down Fifth Avenue? I mean, you're not supposed to see them, and they're lower than the buildings. Police are everywhere. No one knew what was going on. You just knew life wasn't going to be the same ever again. My life for sure wasn't the same ever again, because my brother was 28 years old. He didn't actually have a life. And for me, it was just a lot of recovery, a lot of therapy, I guess in a good way, 2 failed suicide attempts, and finding out who you could rely on, what family, what friends. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do anything. I was told I would walk around with a pillow and my brother and mine's picture on top of the pillow and wouldn't let anybody touch it. And I was told that by many people. And I remember parts of that, but a lot of things are blurry in my mind. And the pieces that I'm telling you are the pieces that I remember more vividly than the other pieces. I had PTSD. I still have PTSD because I still get flashbacks. I had survivor guilt I got my brother the job there. I got Scott the job at Cantor Fitzgerald. One of my friends hired him. And I told him he had to go to work that morning. The day before, he had laid off 50 people at Cantor Fitzgerald. He knew it was coming. He was having what I thought were nightmares and trauma as a result of it for about 3 or 4 weeks beforehand, because he kept saying, they're after me, the bad guys are coming, the dreams are happening. He couldn't figure out what was going on. All he kept telling everybody is how much he wanted to be with family and how much he loved them. He kept telling my mom how much he loved them. And my mom, we knew something was wrong. We were arranging for him to talk to somebody. I mean, it's hard, 28 years old, having to lay off 50 people. That's traumatic. And we thought it was all that. And that night, after he laid off the people, he said he still couldn't sleep. They were following him all over. And he didn't want to go to work because he said they kept following him. And I made him go to work. So I blamed myself a lot. Obviously, I know it's not me, but part of me will always think if I didn't get him the job, or if this, then I'm like, well, if the subway was 5 minutes late, like it usually is, we would have not have been there yet. But I don't, you can't, it's what happened. I don't remember, none of my memories are without him. I was 2 years and 3 months older, but I don't remember anything without him. And as we got older, somewhere along the line, we became friends. Our groups commingled when we got older. You know, we go out in Manhattan, we go down to LBI at the shore. We became friends. And so I lost one of my best friends. I see a lot of him in my kids. I sometimes joke I gave birth to my own brother, because my son has his sports abilities, significant abilities. My daughter has his blue eyes and blonde hair. And as you can see, I'm not blue-eyed or blonde. And we don't know where it is on my husband's side. And they can't remember how far back it has to be. Obviously, it's there someplace, but nobody knows where it is. I still see him in my dreams. The hardest part is for me is when my kids ask why they can't meet their Uncle Scott or see their Uncle Scott. And I say that he's in heaven, and they are like, well, where is heaven? Because to them, everything's a place on a map. And I have to try and explain it in a way that 4.5-year-olds and a 2.5-year-old could understand without telling them too much. So that's hard for me right now. I found ways to make sure people remember him. I fought the town I grew up in, North Edison, and I got our street named after him. I got a bench in Central Park named for him outside of Tavern on the Green. We have a butterfly garden at our grammar school that was funded by neighbors. It's just ways that we can find ways to remember him. I've been to the tower since everything happened. For me, it doesn't look normal, it doesn't look right, and I don't know why anybody in their right mind would want to be in a building that tall ever again, but that's your choices. It wouldn't be mine. I couldn't take it. I had a special color that said I was a family member. I went with my husband. And security obviously knows what that pass color means. And they kind of stick around by you just in case people want to read your badge. And I went into the room where they went into the full details, and I lost it. And they rushed me out to the family center and let me just sit where a security guard there's a whole area where only family can go. And you could relive a rest, and they have it sounds stupid, but they have water and like a little snack for you just so that you can gather your composure again. And you could stay there or you could continue. I stayed there. It was hard. I've only been there once since being out here. I went to every memorial through the first 10, both the big Trade Center one and Cantor Fitzgerald's has their own. I've met a lot of people through it, other siblings, and of course, you know, obviously there's the politicians and anybody else that is somewhat of a VIP, whatever. But I've gone to all of them, and it's hard. It's very hard to be down there. For me, it doesn't look like it should look. They're just rebuilding right on top of it. And for me, I wish they never did. We're one, I guess, lucky, for lack of a better word, that they found a part of my brother. I don't know what part my dad does, and it will die when he passes. And hopefully that's not soon. My mom and I will not tell us what they found. We do know it's not that big. But he was found with, they told you where he was found and who he was found with. So he was found with his coworkers, which means at least they were all together. But I fought long and hard to get to a point where I'm a survivor. There's not much that can be done to me anymore that I can't survive. You learn your family is the most important thing in the world. And in my house, we have a rule. We always say we love each other every day and we give each other hugs because you don't know when the last one's gonna be. Obviously there are some details that I don't even remember, which is probably for the best, but I'm here. It took me a while to get off the meds they put me on. I needed them to go to sleep, to wake up and make it through the day for about 4 years. But I'm here. And that's what I keep telling myself. And that's what's important.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me, and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great. And I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25WHAT to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25WHAT.
Here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%, so I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
Probably up till now, most people out here didn't know about my brother, about Scott, and what I went through. But yeah, there's a big divide. I think people don't remember it out here. I don't know if it's thought of as much. Back East, the major networks will run every memorial with the names on the bottom. You're lucky if you see like a 5-minute glimpse here as they're discussing traffic on the highway. It's not thought of the same. I don't see it being the same. People don't, it's just like an ordinary day, and it's not. And if you were back East, it's not an ordinary day. They need to know that it's families, it's people who died. It's not just the building that came down and the lawsuits over the buildings and the rent that were afterwards. There's 3,000 people that passed away with 4 planes going down between New York, Pennsylvania, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and DC. Those are what you have to remember. Those 3,000 people didn't get to live their lives. They all have family members. They have brothers, sisters, moms, dads, kids. Some of those kids never even knew their parents. That's what people need to remember. But I think if you weren't personally impacted, it's just like another day to you. Okay, I'm just gonna go on. You went to work the next day. I didn't go to work for a month and a half. And I know people will sit there and compare and say, well, we know we've lost loved ones, but you got to say goodbye. And that's what I keep telling people. I didn't get to say goodbye. We just went to work. We went to work in a business on Wall Street. We did not do anything that would have caused it. I lost faith. I mean, I know that I am Jewish, and that's why I go to the JCC, and my kids go to the JCC preschool. I'm not sure there's a God up there anymore. And even there's even Sister Elizabeth, because Catholic Charities came to our house a lot. Sister Elizabeth was the sister. She's like, you don't have to believe in there. If that's what you need to not believe in, you don't believe. I don't know if there is one up there, because I can't imagine someone allowing this to happen. So it's really hard for me to reconcile that. I talk to my brother almost every day. I talk to my family a lot. For my wedding, we set up a place setting for him, and we left the groom spot open because that would have been his place. My son is named for my brother. Stephen is named for Scott. My husband thought we'd be naming. I couldn't use the same name. It just was too hard for me. I didn't want to look at my son's face and cry every 5 minutes. So we chose the same initials. So yeah, every day I remember. I have the flag that we got. It's in my house. But as I said, I guess unless you know me, you don't know this is my story.
Joe Falco.
We get a run in the morning around 8:30 to Penn Station for an EMS call. So we go to Penn Station, and I'm waiting at the taxi ramp, and where we always park, and the guys go into Penn Station looking for the victim. All of a sudden, over the radio, I hear the chief from downtown calling up Pfeiffer, saying he has a confirmed plane into the World Trade Center. So right away, I call the officer on the radio, and I tell him that we have a confirmed plane into the World Trade Center. So they came back, you know, within minutes. Ambulance showed up to take care of the patient. They came right back to the rig. Started making a second alarm automatically, and it's a third alarm, and we're on our way back to the firehouse, which is only a block away. We get to the firehouse, we back into the building, and now the guys are watching it on TV. Now it becomes a fifth alarm, and this is only minutes later. Engine one goes. So now we get the ticket to go to the box. And now it's, I'm not sure the exact time, whatever time it was, a little before 9 or 9 o'clock exactly, we go and we get transmitted to go. So the one guy, Kirk, he says, "You want to drive? Or you want me to drive?" So I was already driving. I was still in the rig. So I said, "No, I'll drive." Because I was getting off that morning. I was supposed to go home. But I was waiting for a detailed to come to the firehouse. So Kirk should have been driving that day. But since I was already driving tonight, he said, I drove. So we get down to the Trade Center. Everybody gets off the rig. And I don't even remember the ride down there. All I know is I got there fast. I mean, there was traffic, but we weaved in and out, and the cops had side roads blocked, and we got there so fast that it was, pretty amazing how fast we got there. So we parked the rig, and I get as close as I can get, which is, it's a lot of rigs are in the way. Everybody gets off. I get off. I get dressed. I get my gear, and I go in and see now the guys are ahead of me. They're already in the building by the time I get there. So I catch up with the officer and the men in Tower 2's lobby, Tower 1's lobby, I'm sorry. And I tell, he sees me. So he says, "I don't want you in the building," he says to me. This is Lieutenant Desperito. He says, "Go outside and help somebody get water or get water yourself." Meaning help somebody hook up to the building and pump water into the building, or if I can find a hand rig with my rig, to do it myself. So I tell him, okay. So as I look out the door, the windows of the Trade Center, I see 65 engine. He's right in the middle of the highway, and he's in the process of hooking up to a hydrant. So I make my way over to him. Now, I have no recollection of anything in the lobby. I mean, they said that there were, there was bodies around, there was debris everywhere. I don't remember any of that. I mean, I was like, whatever. I didn't focus on any of that. All I did know that there was, you could hear thump, crash, and crash. That was just, people jumping, hitting all over the place. So you had to watch. When you couldn't just go out the door. You had to stop and wait till it was clear and then go. So I went across the street to the chauffeur, and I knew him, but I didn't know his name. We run in with him a lot, but I just didn't know his name. So we hook up to the hydrant. We charge the line, and now we're looking at the building. And it's a direct shot right across the street to where the connection on a standpipe is for the building. And it is impossible to hook up there. There's debris falling off the building. There's still people jumping off the building. And it's right in our path where we got to go. So I said to him, I said, we can't go over there and hook up. We'll get killed going over there. Something will fall on us. So he looks around, and he notices a hydrant right on the corner of Liberty and West Street. So we pack everything back on the rig, and we take his rig, we drive it over around to, now we're in front of the hotel on Liberty and West. And he noses the rig in, we hook up to the hydrant, and we stretch a line down the sidewalk to that same standpipe. And he hooks up, I hook it up to the rig, and now the rig is pumping water, and we're just sitting there watching what's going on. And like I say, debris is constantly falling down. You have to watch, because stuff is coming down. You have to watch every second. And to the side of us is a parking lot, pretty big parking lot, full of cars, packed. And there's cars on fire from debris, I guess, when the plane hit. Stuff came down, and now these cars are on fire. And it's just right across the road from where we are, just a road's width away from us. So we decide, well, let's try to, we'll try to put these car fires out, because we're going to be here all day. Well, we figured we'd be there all day, all night, and who knows when you'd get this fire out. Never in a million years I thought that the building was coming down. So we hook up a line to, we didn't even hook it up to the rig, we went right to the hydrant, because it was another hydrant right opposite of it. So we had one length of hose, hooked it up, and I was trying to put this van fire out, couldn't put it out. Just for some reason, it wouldn't go out. And the whole time, I'm looking up at the building on top of me, because now this is Tower 2, the South Tower, and stuff is falling down, light stuff, but it's falling everywhere, everything, all around us. And so after a few minutes, I said, forget it. We'll just keep an eye on it. And if it gets really bad, then we'll worry about it later. Because it was just too dangerous to be in that position with your back to the building. shut everything off. And now, as we stop doing that, a police officer comes to the door of the hotel lobby, and he yells to us, "Let me know when it's clear to let people out." So I got in the middle of the street, and the other fella is halfway between me and the cop. And I'm looking, I can get a better view from where I was. So I tell the other guy, clear. So the cop sends people out of the building, but it wasn't that many people, maybe 20 people. And a person comes out in a wheelchair, a person comes out in a stretcher, and then they bring these people over to the south pedestrian walkway. And there's a few ambulances parked under the walkway. And now these people are getting, whoever had to be taken care of is getting taken care of by those ambulances. So we did that, and now a few more EMS people come up. So we relinquished the street to them. They were taking care of the people. So we said, let them evacuate, you know, they can direct people out of the hotel. Going back to when I came out of the building and I hooked up with the chauffeur 65 engine, there, the rig is right there, 65 engine. And as far as you could look to your left and as far as you could look to your right, there were nothing but body parts. I mean, everywhere. And they were just, I mean, there wasn't, you know, hardly any space in between parts. I mean, it was just everywhere. And before we decided not to hook up to that standpipe in front of the building, an engine pulls up right where the standpipe was. And we're still thinking about what we're going to do. At that moment, as that rig pulls up, all of a sudden, a person lands on top of the rig. You hear a big thud. So that's when we said, we can't hook up over there. You know, we're going to get hit. That was our main deciding factor, is not to hook up there when that person fell on top of the rig, right in front of where we had to go. So we went back to the rig, and this is when this other fella shows up, the guy Kevin Shea from 35 Truck. He comes out of nowhere, and he says, you want to try to put these fires out? So I said, well, we tried already. We couldn't do it. I said, you know, the three of us, we'll try. So we try to put them out. We stretched the line on the one side of the staircase of the pedestrian walkway on the north side. And we couldn't get a good shot at the van. So we wanted to come around to the back side and shoot between the two back windows of the van. So we bring the hose line on the north, on the south side of the walkway, right next to the staircase, behind the staircase, actually. And the guy Kevin is on the nozzle. I'm backing him up on a hose. And the other guy, who I cannot think of his name, it's from 65 Engine, he's standing there, standing watch. So I'm constantly looking up at this building, because stuff is, like I say, is just falling everywhere. And we were operating maybe 5 minutes. With the hose line, I don't know if it was much more than that, even if it was 5 minutes. I looked up one time, and the building's just crumbling down, coming down. So I yelled to the two guys to run. Now, this time, I don't know that it's the whole building. I just think, you know, a large piece of debris is coming down, you know. So I yell to them to run. I turn and I'm running south up the West Side Avenue. Because it's not the highway, that's just West Side Avenue. So I'm running south. I didn't get very far, and the force of the air coming down with the building coming down, first thing I remember was my arms went out like Superman. My helmet went flying off. And once my helmet went off, I said, I'm in trouble, because now something's going to hit me in the head. And stuff is pounding me in the back, like somebody's punching you in the back. It's just the dust and everything coming down, but it's coming down from 1,000 feet up. So it's like somebody beating you. So now as it gets stronger, I go into a tumble, and I'm just tumbling head over heels, rolling. And it's not black yet, but it's dark. And I said to myself that I'm not dying like this. I know I said that. And I just get tumbled, and I'm going sideways. And before it got dark, the last thing I remember, at least I think I remember, is I'm hitting the center divider on the highway, and I get pushed up and over it onto the other. I could see, the last thing I saw was the white of the divider. Got hit to it, rolled right up onto the other side, and thrown onto the other end. And as this is happening, why, I don't know, but either I yelled it or I heard it, my daughter's name. It's the only thing I remember. You know, people say your life goes before your eyes. Well, one thing I heard was my daughter's name, Jessalyn. And now I don't know if I got knocked out. I don't know how much time passed. But I'm on the other side, and I'm laying flat on the ground. And when I realize it, you know, I'm not even breathing anymore, because it's pitch black, as dark could ever be. And I think I stopped breathing, just was holding my breath. And I'm laying there. You can't hear a sound. You can't see anything. I didn't feel any pain. I didn't feel anything. So I said to myself, well, I must be dead. And so I'm laying there, and the first thing I thought of was, there's no light. You know, where's the light? Everybody says when you die, you see this bright light. Well, there's no light. So I'm saying, there's no light. Something's wrong. So then within seconds, all of a sudden, you can hear, you could feel stuff, and I could taste, you're coughing up, and you know now that you're not dead. You know, you just, you're sitting there hurt. And the whole time in my mind, I'm thinking that I got to be buried under rubble, because it was like a freight train right on my back, the steel just crumbling and everything else happening so loud that I thought I had to definitely be buried. You know, stuff had to be on top of me. So my first instinct was to reach up and out, and I reached around, and I didn't feel anything. So I felt better. I said, well, if I am buried, at least I got room. I'm not, in a tight spot. So now my knee, my back, my whole body is hurting, I feel the pain coming back. So I go to get up, and I can't even stand up because of my leg. So I'm just laying there, and dust is starting to settle. I have no idea what the time frame is, but I know dust is starting to come down. And in front of me, a few feet, maybe 10, 15 feet away, I see headlights. And then I can start to see the outline of an ambulance. And so now I still think I'm buried. So I'm saying, well, I feel much better. Now, there's an ambulance in here. You know, it must be a big void. You know, at least there's a radio in the ambulance, something I can get to contact somebody. But I still can't move. And as time goes by, dust settles a little more. I look the other way, and I can see another ambulance, maybe 25 feet away from me, facing the other direction. I could see the outline of it. You couldn't make out what it was, but you knew it was an ambulance. So I'm sitting there, and in the distance, which I believe, I don't even know, I think it was from the south coming at me, southwest coming towards me. I see some guys coming with flashlights, firemen, and they're yelling, anybody here, anybody here? So I yell to them, they come over to me, and you're right, you're right. I said, yeah, I'm good, I'm all right. And that made me feel a little better too, knowing that there was other people around. So now they leave, and within a minute or less, I hear a guy yelling from in front of the van, the ambulance, that he's trapped, help me, help. So now, at this moment, I try to stand up. So I get up on the one leg, and I can't move, I can't walk from where I am to the ambulance because there's so much debris in the way. So I got as far as I could, and I couldn't lift my leg up. So I get over to as far as I can, and then I just sat on a pile of debris, and I started yelling for help. So out of the distance, and the front of the van's on fire. There's a fire now. An EMS guy comes over with a fire extinguisher, and it's still you can't breathe, and you can't really see too well, so dusty. The guy's got a dry chemical extinguisher, and he's going to put the dry chemical on this fire. So I yelled to him, don't do that. I said, the guy can't breathe now. I said, the dry chemical, forget it. So he just pulled the debris away and away from the ambulance. At the same time, the three or four firemen that passed me earlier came back, and I told them that there's a guy caught under the ambulance. I can't get him. Luckily, the four of them, the one EMS guy and the fireman, were able to drag whatever was in front of the ambulance away, and the guy got up and he just walked away. I don't know where he went after that. He just walked into the dust. Getting back to the part when I was laying there in the pitch black darkness after the tower had collapsed and I got thrown to the ground. A fellow from Seven Truck was also a volunteer in Freeport with me. I've known him since he was a kid. His name is Richie Muldowney, and we had an ongoing thing for years in the firehouse, in the fire department in the city. He was in Seven Truck on the east side, and I'm in one engine, which is on the west side, almost directly across. He's on 29th Street between 2nd and 3rd, and we're on 31st Street between 6th and 7th. So almost directly across. So in a lot of runs, a lot of boxes, we run in together. If it's in the middle, we go to the east side, they come over to the west side sometimes, but a lot of times we run in together. So in order to know if he was working or if I was working, we'd get on the radio, on a handy talkie, and we would just say, boy. And if he was working, he would say, hey, boy, back. Or if he called first, I would say, hey, boy, back. And it was just a way that we knew that each other were working that day, that night. So this is going on. This went back for years and years, even before he was in the fire department and myself. back when we were Volleys in Freeport. This whole boy thing started way back then. And it just continued on. Every time we saw each other, we called each other boy. So while I was laying in the ground before anything, I got any sense of where I was or what have you, I hear the word, hey boy. Now, it's nothing I can hear or see, but I hear hey boy. Now, I have no idea that Richie's working that day. I don't even know that, you know, 7 Truck is there. I mean, assume, but I didn't thought of it. You know, I didn't think of it that way. And come out to find out later, you know, of course, that he didn't make it that day. He was working. And, you know, is it something I just thought in my mind? Or was he really talking to me that day? So I'm sitting there and I'm saying, you know, what am I going to do? I can't do anything. I can't walk. I can't. And then out of nowhere, I'm covered from head to toe with dust. And more people are coming around. And then out of nowhere, 2 guys from my firehouse show up. They were in the hotel lobby when the building came down. Their whole company, they got out, and somehow they walked all the way, they went around the way they came out, and we just met eyes. And it was Tyrone Johnson and Jimmy Grillo from Light of 24. So they come over to me, and two of them, helped me get up, and they said, we got to get over by the water to get away from the buildings. All right, so Jimmy's got a broken nose, his arm is all messed up. So they helped me get over and away. So now, when you got a bad leg and somebody's dragging you or helping you walk and they're pulling you too soon, too fast, and they're killing me. That, you know, my leg is just hurt so bad that I just forget it. Let me do it on my own. You know, I'll just take it easy. So now we walk. We're walking away, and just as we get in front of the North Tower, and now it's clear. Now you can get good visibility, and you can see that the other tower's already down. And so we just get in front of that, but we're in front of it, but on the other side of the highway, far enough away from it. And myself and Tyrone, we hear the pancaking of the boom, boom, boom. We turn around and we see that building coming down. So now I went from not being able to walk to running. So the 3 of us start running out of the way. Again, the dust cloud, the air, and everything starts, the dust, you know, starts pelting you. We didn't fall down, but it was enough to knock you down and choke you. And this time I was able to put my head in my coat to breathe. So in the distance, I could see that there were stairs, and then you went down to the water's edge, and it was a brick, a concrete wall that went along the waterway. So I just started to walk. I said, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. You know, I couldn't run anymore. So I'm just taking one step at a time, and I found the staircase. It's only a couple of steps. I walk down the stairs, I get to the concrete wall. I knew I had to go north, so I turned to the north, and I just started walking out until I came out of the dust cloud. So now I can see Jimmy, he's already out of the dust cloud pretty much, and he's, you know, near the edge, the water's edge. So I almost get to him, and I turn, and there's Tyrone's not behind me, and I'm just looking at, I didn't want to go back into it to go back to, you know, just didn't want to go back into it. I said, well, I can't leave him. I got to go back. So I take like 2 steps, and by the time I took 2 steps, because I wasn't moving too quick, I could see a shadow coming at me. And thankfully, it was Tyrone. He didn't see the stairs. He fell down the stairs. So by the time he got up and got himself together, so the 3 of us walked north out of the dust cloud. And that is boats and everything taking people from New York to Jersey. And I now, once I get, you know, your adrenaline stops and everything else, I couldn't walk at all. My leg was just, I couldn't even take a baby step. It was just so bad. So they're telling me, well, get on a boat and I'll take you to Jersey, to the hospital. Well, I didn't want to go to Jersey because, you know, I didn't know where the rest of my company was. You know, I didn't know where. We knew that the guys in the truck were right because they were on the radio with them. But the engine guys, none of them, engine one guys, none of them were answering the radios. So they convinced me finally to get on a boat. So I got on a boat, and they brought me to Jersey City Medical Center. They had a big triage area set up on the Jersey side. And they wheeled me off on a stretcher. They put me on a park bench, and then everybody left me. I'm there all by myself. There's nobody, you know, taking care of me, no nothing. Finally, a couple of guys come over, they take my blood pressure and everything out, and then they leave. And like, I'm just sitting there by myself. And a woman came by and she wanted to know if there was anybody I wanted her to call for me. And I gave her my wife's number at work. And she finally, eventually, in the course of the day, she was able to get through to her to tell her that I was all right. And so eventually they put me in an ambulance and they brought me to Jersey City Medical Center. And they were mobbed. It was just mass confusion over there. They had so many people they evacuated to Jersey. Because they figured that New York would be overrun. Meanwhile, it was the other way around. Jersey was overrun, and New York had hardly anybody. So I went to so they checked me out, and he took X-rays, stitched up my leg where it was torn open, and then they put us in a room, just cops, firemen, and EMS people. Separate, no windows, so we couldn't see anything. So we're sitting all up there. I'm covered from head to toe. I'm filthy. And they were letting guys go take showers, get cleaned up. And everybody kept asking me if I wanted to go take a shower. And I just didn't feel like doing anything at the time. I just wanted to sit there. And I kept saying, no, I'm all right. So I'm watching these other fellas taking showers. They were dirty, but, there was nothing really that bad, some of them. And finally, I go and take a shower. I'm talking like hours later, I finally go. So I walk past the mirror in the bathroom, and I'm, so much dust on my hair and my face, and I'm, black. Soot all over me, and I said, "Oh, I guess that's why they wanted me to take a shower. I'm so dirty." So I just had stitches in my leg, and they say, "You're not supposed to get your stitches wet." Well, how are you going to take a shower if you don't get your stitches wet? So I used a bottle of shampoo and a bar of soap. Finally, got most of the dirt off me, and came back. They rebandaged my leg, and that got infected after a few days, and then. I asked the nurse, or not even the nurse, one of the caseworkers there. There was a bunch of women there, getting us whatever we needed. They were very nice. I asked her, I said, is there any way we can find out who's in the hospital? Other guys from our company, so we know, if they're here or not. So she said, well, she would go downstairs and make a list. They had a bunch of blackboards in the triage area, and it had your name and your medical condition on it. So she goes, I'll go find out. So she comes back with a bunch of papers, and there's names all over it. Some are firemen, some are civilians, some are cops. It could be anybody. So finally, I see a name of my lieutenant who's on it. Actually, that lieutenant was working in the truck that day. He's Lieutenant Engine 1, but he was working in 24 truck as a lieutenant. So I see Blake McLaughlin. So I asked the nurse, I said, does this mean that they're here and fine, or does this just mean that they've been brought here, they could be deceased? And then she didn't know. She says, I don't know. They're just on the board. Sorry. It's like 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, here comes Blake walking into the room, which I was glad to see because now I had somebody with me. A few minutes later, I'm like, I was pretty shaken up, And when Blake got there, I said, I wish I could talk to Father Mike, Father Michael Judge, because he was the priest in the church across the street from us, St. Francis of Assisi, and he's also the fire department chaplain. And he was, really good guy, and we all knew him in the firehouse very well. So I didn't know it at the time. So he tells me, he says, oh, you don't know? I said, what? He said, Father Mike didn't make it. And that, really took me for a loop. Finally, they brought us back to New York in a bus that they got from New Jersey. And they dropped us off at different firehouses, and then we had to get a ride back to our firehouse. And then a few friends of mine, Bill Shimeri and Rick Holdner, they drove in. And I'm not even sure what time it was, 10 o'clock at night or something like that, maybe a little earlier. And they were able to get into the city, and then they drove me home because I couldn't drive. Injuries were, that was another thing when I was in the hospital. Their big thing was, they said, well, did you black out? I said, I don't know. How would I know if I blacked out? So I think if I would have stayed in New York, I would have got better care. I don't really think I got too good of care over in Jersey. I think I definitely should have stayed the night. I mean, they sent me home, it was like getting hit by a car with, the injuries, I got, they didn't really know if I had any kind of internal injuries or anything. They were so overwhelmed. I can't really blame them. They just had, limited staff and so many people to take care of. So, but I just think if I was in New York, St. Vincent's or one of the other big hospitals, that I would have been to my betterment. Because the next day when I woke up, I had a big lump on the one side of my head, on the right side. And the next day, I had about 100 lumps on my head from getting hit in the head. So I'm sure I should have stayed overnight for observation at least. And so my injuries were, I was basically hurt from head to toe. Every part of my body was injured. My big injuries were my shoulder, my left shoulder, which is, I need a shoulder replacement. The doctor says there's nothing they can do for it. The joint is messed up. And my left knee was the one that I had casted, I had it operated on. I had, the whole knee was torn apart, ACL, the PCL, cartilage, all cartilage damage. The had a broken, a crack in the tibia. I got a crushed bone in the tibia, the top of the tibia. My right side, they got torn ACL. I have torn meniscus. And I had the left side was repaired. They repaired the ACL and the PCL. while I was in a cast for the month, that went back, the bone was split, and the bone healed itself, and so that was all right. Medial collateral ligament, they thought they would have to reattach that, thought it was stretched, but while being in a cast for a month, that shrank back on its own, so that was all right. So I had that operation, the ACL reconstruction, and it's over with, but I'm in constant pain every day. It's just something you have to live with. You know, doctors need knee replacement. And until I do that, I'm just in pain, 24/7. I just have to watch what I do. You know, if I got to kneel down, you got to think about it before you just go actually do it. You know, you just can't just kneel down. You got to, which knee am I going to kneel with, my left one or my right one? And then I went in for an operation on my right knee, and the doctor said that he wouldn't do it. He said he wouldn't replace the ACL because you have too much damage to that knee. And replacing the ACL will just make the knee tighter and you'll be in more pain. He says, you need two knee replacements. And so I need two knee replacements and a shoulder replacement. But he recommends, he advised me to hold off on everything, to, you're too young to do it right now. And he advised about the shoulder replacement to really hold off on that, because once you get a shoulder replacement, you're really limited to what you can do. And my son doesn't show it much now. I think, I don't know if it doesn't affect him or he's just able to hide it more. And my daughter seems like it really affected her. She was, at the time, she was 11. Or was she 10? I have a problem with her age. I always forget her age. And she had a problem with it. She still has a problem. Whenever I go into the city, different functions, I go back to the firehouse or whatever, she had a problem with me going back into the city. And yeah, she took it hard. I'm sure both of them did. And also my wife, coming so close to losing me. And again, the other wives in the firehouse, different functions, and you see them, and then it all takes a toll on them, even though I'm still here, but it still bothers them. In the beginning, I don't know if they were nightmares so much where, nightmare would scare you. These were just a lot of dreams. I mean, and it was a lot of, basically it was one dream that I had over and over, that I was in a staircase, and the staircase, they weren't the way the staircases are in the Trade Center. They were like a long hallway, and then another stair going up. It wasn't, a really long hallway. So I'm standing on the landing in the staircase, and the whole building is collapsing in front of me, and coming down like a chute, almost everything. Just the staircase is just collapsing one on top of the other, and then you just see civilians and firemen just going past you as everything's collapsing. But I'm standing there on an area that's fine. I had that dream quite a few times, and then just constantly on your mind, every day. You're always. One way or another, you wake up thinking about it, or you go to sleep thinking about it, or you do both. And it still happens to this day that something will happen, and it's basically on your mind 24/7. Not to the part where you can't function, but you're always thinking about it, about the guys. So many guys that were lost that day, and so many of them that you knew. A lot of times, oh yeah, I know that guy. Hey, how you doing? There was a lot of guys that you knew by face, by name, that you actually had, you talked to. Guys from my firehouse, You know, we had four guys from my firehouse alone that were, you know, good friends. It was Captain Bruffel of Ladder 24, Steve Belson from 24 Truck, who was working as an aide that day for Oreo Palmer. And actually, Captain Bruffel drove Father Michael Judge down there that day to the scene. He got off that morning. And then Mike Weinberg from Engine 1, who came from home. Of course, his sister worked in the Trade Center, so he went down there to see what, you know, make sure she was right. He ended up with Captain Bruffel. They were found together when after the aftermath. And then the other guy was Lieutenant Desperito, Andy Desperito from Engine 1. All the guys from Engine 1 made it out, and he didn't. He was with a fellow from the Port Authority. He was right behind everybody. And he was also involved with, I believe, the guys from Ladder 6 who were trying to help that woman out, Josephine. All the guys, because they were all, said they were all together at one time on the staircase helping her down, and then they got split up. And the fella that he was with from the Port Authority is fine, and he was right next to him, and you know, he didn't make it. So, like I say, those kind of things, you're always, you know, you'll always remember those things.
Thanks to Jocelyn Dong and the Palo Alto Weekly for permission to use the Lori Brody audio. The Palo Alto Weekly YouTube channel is youtube.com/PAWeekly. Thanks to Mike Shimeri for his permission to use the Joe Falco audio. Mike's father, Bill, currently works as a volunteer with Joe Falco at the Freeport Fire Department Truck Company. Mike is the host of an instrumental music radio show on public radio station WCWP. You can check out his work at his website, mikeshimeri.com. That's MikeShimeri.com. Music for this episode provided by Kevin McLeod. You're listening to What Was That Like? I'm Scott Johnson. See you next time.